So we're going to talk some about step five now. In page 72, there's a chapter into action. There is no chapter into activity. There's a difference between activity and action. There's a lot of busy work. So I'm a busy work around Alcoholics Anonymous. In that first paragraph of Into Action, it starts to talk about the fifth step. It says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and discover the obstacles in our path. So that's what we're trying to do here. It says we have admitted certain defects and ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. I think that it's important to point out that in this paragraph it refers to admitting certain defects, but also it says we've admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. And this brings us to step five, to the fifth step of the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapters. So, as I mentioned before, every time the book talks about the nature of something, I believe it's referring to something that's inside rather than outside. So here it refers to defects in two different ways. It says we've admitted certain defects, we've also have admitted the exact nature of our defects. I think that a lot of people think that their focus is supposed to be on the all these things that these defects of behavior. I think what becomes more important is the idea that what's going on inside rather than outside. Because even though there's behavior out here that we find defective, we have to see that there's something going on inside that come from, that these defects come from. So we have to see the nature of these defects. As we go through the inventory, I like to ask, along with all the other conversation that goes on, there's some questions I like to ask, and it actually comes from the sixth step. As I'm listening to somebody's inventory, what I ask them is, can I see the behavior here that I've done as objectionable? Right? And the next question is, can I see that on my own power, could I have behaved any different? And is there any part of this resentment that I'm still clinging to? It's easy to turn the fifth step into sort of a therapeutic process where I'm going to analyze what's happening, like we're going to figure out what I'm going to do about the things that have come up. When I look at it like this, when I'm looking at back and seeing that on my own power, by myself, I couldn't behave any different in that moment, I'm seeing a blueprint of what it looks like in my life to live life based on self-reliance. Right? And without God, I have to see that I hadn't been able to live any different. What I like to talk about is that also I don't make a list of character defects when we're writing inventory. I believe that the list of character defects actually come out in my self-seeking actions and selfish attitudes. Because any defect of your behavior is either going to be an action or an attitude, right? It fall under either of those. But what becomes really important is to see where those come from, the nature of the defects. So when I write inventory, the way that I write inventory, seeing that the deep-seated fears and the self-delusions that that those actions and attitudes come from, right, that's where I'm going to see the nature of my defects. The nature of my defects is that I have fears that set up self-delusions. Right? And the defects that you see out here come from that. A lot of times, the fact is that I can try to change my behavior. I can try to stop doing certain defects. But the fact is that what I have to see is that I haven't been able to do anything about the nature of those defects. Right? The deep-seated fears and the lies that I tell myself, the self-dishonesty, those things are inside, and that's what I need God's help with. So the process becomes less a therapeutic process and more a spiritual process when I've looked at it as how have I lived without God.
So the fifth step is when it starts to get this is where these things are going to be cast out. What does it say here? It says, now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part. So we're going to get into action. And the funny thing about action is that we're going to sit still and we're going to be quiet and we're going to wait for these answers to come. In reading our inventory, it becomes a very intimate. We're going to admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Now you take that and you break it down. So I'm going to admit to God. Why am I going to admit to God? God is already knows all and sees all, right? Why am I admitting to God? Well, because I have got a God of my own understanding, and now I'm going to put God in the seat next to me. And I'm going to admit to God. Now, God isn't in the clouds or in the, deepest ocean or in the stars. He's in the seat next to me. I'm going to admit to God. And I'm going to admit to myself because I'm starting to see that I'm not the person I thought I was. So I'm not looking at, I'm looking at, and I'm seeing that I don't want to be the person that I see in this inventory. And I admit to myself, I can't do anything to make that go away. I can't wish myself into a better way. What do they say? Think your way into a better way of living. I can't do any of those things. I can't make this go away on my own. So I'm admitting that in and of myself, I can't cast these things out. So I need God. So I'm going to admit to God. To myself, I'm going to see the person. Why am I admitting to myself? Because I see a person that I didn't really know. So I'm going to admit to myself the nature of my wrongs, like Dan was talking about, within. And I see how it is important to read this to another human being, right? That I get. You have confession and all these different things in some fixed religions to confess to somebody your sin. So I admit to God, intimate relationship with God now. I admit to myself because I'm starting to see without God I'm nothing. And I admit to another human being. So I'm having an intimate relationship with God, intimate relationship with myself, and an intimate relationship with another human being. So what that does is it starts to, I start to see how these things are going to be cast out of my life, these resentments. They're going to be cast out. They're not going to be solved. They're not going to be worked on. I'm not going to look at, I'm not going to put the finger on the pulse of Sheldon and then act a different way. Right?
So I think that, as much work as it is, it's an honor to be asked to listen to a fifth step, right? Because what you gained is somebody's complete trust, hopefully. So hopefully they're willing to tell you all their life story, to go into every nook and cranny of their life, and you know, and hopefully are able to, you know, just be willing to sit and just listen, read everything to you. Personally, my first inventory, I remember I had tucked some away in the back that I told myself I really wasn't going to read to anybody. And I guess Joe was a little too experienced with that. Because as soon as I sat back and looked like I was finished, he says, "Is there anything else?" And it's, "Oh yeah, there's this stuff here." But by the time I got to that point,
It didn't matter anymore.
It was like, it talks about time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods, therapy, medication. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory, all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not. Learned enough about humility, fearlessness, and honesty. In a sense, we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. It's almost, I guess you'd say, like a cleansing process to be at a place when you're willing to discuss all of this stuff with someone. One of the things that I want to mention too is the word in this paragraph is where it talks about they only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. Egoism is a much different word than ego. Because that's something I hear a lot in meetings too, where people assuming that they're supposed to be free of ego. I don't know that that's possible.
Right.
I mean, truthfully, isn't there something called good ego?
Sure.
Positive ego? And the ISM at the end of that, the ism, if you look in a big dictionary, you'll actually find ism in the dictionary. It's the abnormal state of condition resulting from the excessive use of something. Right? So alcohol is not bad. Alcoholism is bad. Right? Because it's the excessive use of alcohol. So ego is not bad, but egoism is the abnormal state of condition resulting from the excessive use of ego. It's where my ego is so big that it hurts the people around me. Right? Where I'm so full of myself that it's annoying. Right? That's what it says. That's what I believe it says that I have to let go of is the excessive ego. Daniel?
I'm glad you brought this up today. Stuart Weil, he defines ego as a false sense of self. So when I thought about that, I thought, I've been confused for a while about ego, because if I look at that definition, I don't know if that is the definition, but if that's his definition, that led me to believe that, well, if I don't have a false sense of self, then I no longer have an ego.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, the trouble with definitions is there's a lot of them. Just because, you know, you have to look at the context it's used in. Obviously, to have a false sense of self could be egoism, right? Because a false sense of self could be so big that it actually is impacted negatively on the people around me to have a false sense of self.
We need to have ego to exist. The ego is a part of the human condition. I had just enough ego to say yes to all of this. Is that a bad thing? Right? I had just enough ego to meet with somebody. Maybe my ego said, oh, I'll look so good if I work with this person. but yet it's a helpful manner. I'm going in with a helpful manner and a helpful attitude. So I think there's a healthy ego that exists. I think that not all ego is bad. We've been told that through many different religions and psychologists and things like that, and mystics, they've all said something about the ego and the destruction of the ego. Well, we're talking about the destruction of the ego that is blocking us, right? The ego that wants more and more attention, per se, like Dan was saying, egoism. You know, and you look at definitions, like ism has quite a few different definitions. Like, you know, there's not every ism is a bad thing, but you got to look at the context. Because if you look at Buddhism, that's not an abnormal inflation of anything. That's a good thing, right? So I could say, well, you know, ism doesn't mean that to Dan, but the thing is we got to look at the context that we're looking in. The ego is not a bad thing to have, but egoism is an inflated ego, that I'm the best person ever that ever existed. I am God. And that's what inventory starts to show me, how I'm playing God. It says we had to stop playing God. Right? So I have to stop playing God. Well, how am I playing God? I look at my resentment, I do a fifth step, and I start seeing, this is how I'm playing God. I am the God of my universe. I am the universe, kind of thing. So that has to be deflated. I don't think the big book ever talks about getting rid of ego, but deflation.
Says on 673, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents the stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. Right? I can't tell you how many times I've even fooled myself with that. Like, how many times have you started an inventory thinking, I'm not going to have any resentments? Right? Then you pray, and then the list comes.
And you're in trouble.
Right? And you, you know, but the other thing is that when you're interacting with people in the world, there's a certain face that you show them. Right? A look. And even if something happens that's hurtful, maybe I'm sure it's not just a guy thing, but I have an image that I want people to see of who Dan is. And when it comes to inventory, being in a place where I'm willing to discuss what's going on inside becomes really important. Right? What's really going on? And, you know, peel off that mask, you know, and be honest with somebody. So, after we've read this, the part that we actually start reading inventory, first we read, we pocket our pride and go to it. This is on 75. We pocket our pride and go to it. Illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we've taken the step withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone in perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe.
And that's great, because this is where I saw all throughout my inventory how pride was devastating in my inventory. So now I'm going to pocket that. I'm going to put that in my pocket and illuminate. I'm going to shine a light on all of this stuff, every dark cranny of my past, withholding nothing. And this is the promises of the fifth step. When I do a fifth step, I'm going to feel closer to my Creator. My fears are going to fall from me. I'm going to be able to look the world in the eye, because I'm getting rid of these things, casting out all of this. It's going to be cast out, and I'm going to become a free man. I'm not going to be held to the bondage of self, and that's what I asked in the third step, to relieve me of the bondage of self.
If you want an example of fears falling from you, have you ever written an inventory and have the resentment fall away, just gone, right? And then you find yourself interacting with that person at a completely different level, right? Remember, in your inventory, you listed all these fears that were driving this resentment, right? But the resentment gone, what's really is gone is the fears that were driving it, right? So that's an example of the fears falling from us.
So, and they're also, this is the first time they really actually state that this is where I'm going to have a spiritual experience. I can really count on that in this place. Like I said in the beginning, each time a drunk sees a piece of truth, I believe that's a spiritual experience. Wow, look at the truth that's coming out in this inventory. It was so big, they decided to put that in here right now. But now, we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared. We don't like to talk about the drink problem disappearing. If it disappears, then I'm not going to stay sick. And a lot of people like to stay sick in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're going to get free of alcoholism. It's going to disappear. And we're going to have a handle on this with the power of God that's going to flow through us. This is where we start to align our will with God's will.
I think Carl Jung says it best, yeah, on 27, where he talks about what he's been trying to do with Roland Hazard, and where he describes, I believe, what a spiritual experience looks like, where he says, ideas, emotions... Oh, by the way, he wasn't able to instill this on Roland.
He tried.
He tried, but this didn't happen for him because he didn't. What he couldn't accomplish is interesting because in the inventory it talks about, we look at these same things, and the inventory process actually accomplishes what Roland Hazard, what Carl Jung failed to do with Roland. It says ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces in the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. Well, ideas, emotions, and attitudes are what I see in the third column, right? Like my ideas, emotions, and attitudes. And they're suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them, right? My new conceptions and motives is what I wrote in the fourth column, right?
So we got to quit playing God. And there's nothing more honorable than to listen to a fifth step. And there's nothing more powerful than the person that's reading the fifth step to have us willing to listen to it. Because God is going to speak through me to them. And God is going to speak through you to me. So where two or more are gathered, there I'll be. Bill actually incorporated that, where two or more alcoholics are gathered, they can call themselves a group. Because it takes two for the God to be there, to actually be there. And that's where I learned the intimacy. My drinking was a solitude type of life. It was very solitude. This is my drink. I'm going in the alley. I'm drinking this. I'm not sharing it. I'm not doing anything with it, interacting with anybody. This is just me in myself.
So, So we're going to move on to the next paragraph. After we've finished the inventory, during the inventory process, we've looked at the defects of character that we wrote in the fourth column and the nature of those defects. The reason that it's important to see the nature of the defects is to see that there's a part of these defects, the nature of the defects that I can't work on, right? That on my own power, by myself, when these interactions were happening, I couldn't behave any different. So after the inventory is finished, we've already discussed some of these things that are coming up in 6 and 7 while in step 6. During the inventory, the person that when I just finished reading my inventory, I go home and I contemplate what I've just done. Where it says returning home, I find a place where I can be quiet for an hour. It says an hour.
Very specific. It says an hour.
It shouldn't take longer, right? I send people home to consider.
Or less.
I said, how is the sixth step going? They go, I'm still working on it. It's like, no.
What? And I think this is where the sixth step starts. I think the illusion that the sixth step doesn't have a lot of instruction, I think this is where it starts, and I'm going to move in from here to the sixth step.
Carefully reviewing what we've done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we've omitted anything, for we're building an arch through which we shall walk, free men at last. So now it's including the first 5 steps into the 6th step. It's not just a paragraph anymore. Now it's asking us to review everything we've done since the beginning.
And why do we do that?
Because I see defects all the way through the whole process.
Right.
My alcoholism was obviously a defect in my behavior. Right. My agnosticism in step 2 was obviously a defect in my behavior. My playing God was obviously a defect in my behavior. And then each page of my inventory, I see defects in my behavior. So I see defects in my behavior since the beginning. Right? If I'm clear on that, then my work is solid so far. You know, are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement, put in the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? If you know anything about mortar, it's much stronger if sand's mixed into it. If it's just sand alone, it's
brittle,
it cracks, right?
You don't want your arch on some cracky, brittly foundation.
Right. Certainly, the hope is not just that we've analyzed the situations just based on the therapeutic pass through the inventory or through the fifth step. Hopefully, we've incorporated seeing how we've ignored God through all of these situations, and I've acknowledged that on my own power, by myself, I couldn't behave any different. Right? That these defects in my behavior was based in the failure, in my own failure of self-reliance. So here's where the questions that I talk about come from. It says if we can, on top of 76, it says if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step 6. We've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove all the things which you've admitted are objectionable? That's one question. Can I see these things that I've admitted are objectionable? These are things that I'm doing in this hour where I've sent the, when I've gone home with my fifth step that I've just read, or my sponsee is going home with their fifth step, and they're considering things. Have I seen that my behavior is objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? Right? In order for me to come to the place where I have to, where I'm ready for God to take them all, every one, I acknowledge to myself that these were all a result of my ignoring God. These are all a result of me operating on self-reliance, that there was no God in this interaction.
You can take him, but he won't.
I'm sorry?
You can take every one of them, but he won't.
No, the prayer is very clear on what he takes and what is, we'll get to that in a second.
If we still cling to something we'll not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. So am I clinging to any part of the resentment? Am I clinging to any part of the behavior that I'm not willing to let go of? Right? If there's anything here that I'm still clinging to that I'm not willing to let go of, am I willing to turn to God for help with those things? Right?
Right. You don't want to stay stuck here. This is a flow from returning home to looking at six. And if I'm clinging to anything, it gives me specific instructions to let God remove from me the things which
you've admitted are objections.
Yeah, that you admitted what Dan was reading. So I'm going to go to God, and if I'm not willing to have something removed, I just ask God to give me the willingness actually to have that removed. I don't stay stuck here. At least this is a flow, and it flows right into the seventh step. And it says that we say something like this. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Because I don't know what parts of me are good, and I don't know what parts of me are bad, but I want God to be in the shortcoming business. I want Him to deal with my shortcoming. So take me all, good and bad. I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. So there it is. What character defects are going to be removed? The ones I'm working on? No. Because self-helping self is like gasoline on a fire, to put it out. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to have God... Oh, let's see, I lost my train. Single defects of character. I stand in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. So these are the things that are going to be removed. The things that are standing in my way of being useful to the people about me, right? And that separate me from God. So I'm going to ask for those to be removed. And give me the strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Remember the third step prayer. That I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. This is where I consummate it, basically.
And the prayer also doesn't say that we're asking God to remove all our defects of character. What it says here is that we're asking God to remove the defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness right. to God and my fellows. Right? You know, that's another thing you hear people talk about, saying, I'm still, God hasn't removed all my defects of character yet.
Not supposed to.
It's, what I find is that I come to this place trying to be helpful to others, but I come to this place an imperfect person, right? Just because I've done all this work and I'm in, say, the seventh step prayer, doesn't mean I don't have defects anymore. But the hope is that God's got more of me now, right? I'm in a place where I'm useful, right? And I turn to God to try to be a better person.
And when you look at the third step decision, and you look at this prayer here, in the third step I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self and have me bear witness to those that I might help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. Bear witness to my difficulties. So some of my character defects or my difficulties in me overcoming those with God becomes helpful to somebody else. And so now the hardest thing to do in this moment is not to work on me, not to make something happen here, not to try to rearrange my scenery and my ballad to fit myself. So here is where God takes the reins, if you will. Yes.
Can you guys give us an example of a defect that God, that you guys think God is finding in yourself?
My alcoholism. My defect that God would find useful would be that I'm still alcoholic. Right? That all I have is a daily reprieve.
My resentment. You know, they're very useful. I have to start to see here that every resentment I ever had brought me closer to God. Every resentment I'm going to have is useful to bring me back to God. And now I'm bearing witness because of my third step decision, that I'm bearing witness to my difficulties, and as I overcome those difficulties with the power of God, that's helpful to somebody else. It's bearing witness to God's power, that He's the one that removed this or made this better.
Should we move on?
Yeah.
Goes on to say, now we need more action. Without which we find
damn it,
that faith without works is dead.
Killing me.
I've done all this work, right? Come on. let's look at steps 8 and 9. Goes on to say, but a lot of people refer to step 8. They say, well, it's just making a list. But right here it says, we have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So really, we made the list when we took inventory.
Right, and some of those names that you wrote down that really wasn't a resentment?
Now you find out where they're really supposed to go. That's why you let them make the first column in the fourth step just come out in a prayerful way. And don't worry if there's no resentment attached to it, because it's possible that the reason the name came was just this, because they knew there was something attached to the person, to the name, right? And it turns out that what really had to end up is in the eighth step list.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that I had about 50 names for my eighth step list, and 49 of them came right out of the inventory. And there was only one of them that came to me in prayer that wasn't on the list that I needed to add afterwards.
So this is a powerful moment. This is this is where the boys are separated from the men. Basically, I won't refer to where that comes from, but this is where things are going to get really powerful. This is where I'm going to see where God is really working in my life. I'm going to start to approach these people, and some of these people have harmed me more than I've harmed them. I have to look at that, and I have to put out of my mind the wrongs that others have done to me. How do I do that? I ask God to give me the strength for this, so that I can go and approach these people in a forgiving and loving spirit.
When we get to this point, when you're working with somebody, and they get to 8 and 9, and you ask them, what step are they on? They'll always say 9. They rarely say 8. The fact is we spend much more time in 8 than we do in 9.
Right, it's a funny thing when you're in 9, you hear funny noises. Is a good friend. You hear this. You want to know what you're ready to make amends. That's what it sounds like. You knock them on the door. And, go ahead.
8 says we made a list of the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. There's plenty of people that will tell you you can't make amends to them all. Or that you never finish amends. What they're really saying is that I couldn't make amends to them all. That I couldn't finish amends. What I had done was I went through this list of names and I made an index card for each name. The reason I did it on index cards was so that I could sit with it, besides the fact that it was passed down instructions from people that came before me, is I found it really useful to sit with it, pray through the stack and thumb through them, and just ask, what is the next indicated amends for me to make? And my job at this point is not to worry about what's going to happen in the amends. My experience has shown me that I have no way of knowing. Because amends that have ended up, that I thought were going to be simple, have ended up complicated. And other amends that I thought were going to be real complicated turned out to be easy because it was more obvious. So I have no way of knowing what's really going to be easy or complicated. I can't worry about that. In the 8th step here, it's about me becoming willing to make the amends, right? And there's a difference between having the will to do something, which is the thought, and having a willingness to do something. And I look at, it might not be the exact way to describe it, but when I'm working with somebody, what I like to do is separate the difference between having the thought, but it's a good thought that I'm going to make the amends, the will to do it, and the willingness is the action. So if I'm really willing to make these amends, I'm going to set an appointment. I'm going to set an appointment to meet with the person. And I try to do as many as I can face to face. The process for me got, what I found was this has got more and more complicated as I got into it, because there was those ones that I thought that I was never going to make. The ones that I had tucked away kind of hid them, so I didn't have to look at them because I was certain that I was going to try to avoid them. The fact was is that as I started going through this, the power came to do more complicated ones, scarier ones that I thought I couldn't do. But the truth was is that I couldn't do them. The truth was is that I had to see that if I pray into it, that I could be driven beyond the point where my own ability falls short. That became one of the most important parts of the idea of making amends to them all. Because for me, the last 5 were the ones that I thought I was never going to make. And the last 5 were the scariest ones. And the last 5 were the ones that took a more serious effort of prayer to get into it. I found myself, like, with my first wife, she was only 5'2", but it was scary. and I remember sitting with my head on the steering wheel of my car outside her place, just kind of like saying, I'm carrying this AA thing way too far. Because the things that I had to confront her with and the life that she ended up with was certainly not what she had got into this relationship for. But the fact is it was those last amends that I became willing to make through prayer that proved to me, I always thought that if there really was a God that can work in my life, who was so powerful, he would have showed himself, right? That wouldn't have been too much to ask, right? If God is so powerful, why isn't there more proof, right? But the fact is that I've always ignored the proof, right? But here I'm put in a position where I see that my own abilities and my own power is insufficient to follow through with some things that I needed to do, that were really important for me to do. And I saw one right after another that praying into it gave me the courage, it gave me the power to finish each one of those amends.
To have the willingness, yeah.
The fact is that I saw proof. I saw the proof and the biggest movement towards God in those last amends that I was sure that I was never going to do.
So, this is where I really start to see the presence of my Creator. Like Dan was saying, God never showed himself. And now he starts to kind of show himself. And for me to there's some really powerful moments in amends. I did a commercial burglary. And in this commercial burglary, I broke into this facility three times. And I did my time. I came to this part in the book. I talked to my mentors. I talked to Joe. I talked to Don. Don worked in the prison system. He said, you did your time. There's no sense in bringing this back up. It's going to be harmful to others. So I listened to all of that. Well, I was homeless. I had mentioned that I lived on the streets. I stole booze from every liquor store that I could come in contact with. So I was making amends to all the liquor stores that I stole booze from, and all of a sudden I was standing in front of this facility that I had robbed. And there was no intention to go in there, and all of a sudden I was in there. I called it a brownout. I went left instead of right, and I was asking the manager where the owner was. And all of a sudden I'm standing in front of the owner, talking about the two times that I broke in that I didn't get caught for. The power of that is that I was willing to go to jail in that moment. I wanted to get free. And I wanted him to be free because I ruined his business. They sent the dogs in. I bled on a sheepskin carpet that they were never able, they kept bringing that up in court. And it was very harmful, and I saw the harm that I caused, and I wanted to approach them with that. So I don't listen to the people that mentor me anymore. I listen to what they have to say, they direct me, but the final decision is God. The final decision is God. Can I make all these amends? How free do you want to be? How free do you want to be? It was described to me very well that you could take a feather pillow up to the Empire State Building and break it apart, shake all the feathers out, and each one of those is an amend. What if there's a God that's powerful enough to guide me to each one of those feathers? Yeah. That's the power of this moment. That's the power of making amends when you're aligned with God and you've done all of this other work, and people want to poo-poo it because they haven't done this and they don't understand it. And they say, you're making too big a deal out of this, but you know what? I want to be helpful to the people about me now. And if I'm not rid of these things, I'm going to be useless. Page 52.
some of the amends that I had involved parts of my family. There was a will contest, and I was, and I really believe they had no business. They had nothing coming, and I still believe that. They didn't have anything coming, but apparently, money's thicker than blood. Some people are more concerned with what they can grab from others, and it was surprising because they were close family. It was surprising how money changed people, and so this was a situation where I really thought that I was never going to be in a place where I could approach these people. But in pondering what the book was saying, where it specifically talks about going to somebody that we don't like, right? The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude towards him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It's harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feelings, and expressing our regret. And in meditation, I considered this. This was like half my family, actually. This wasn't just one person, because they kind of like grouped together to throw this estate into a will contest. It wasn't really even that much money in the end, but still. Reading this, I looked at this, and it says we go to them in a helpful and forgiving spirit. One of the things that how I read that was that I don't have to forgive them for turning on my side of the family. But I could still go to them with a forgiving spirit, expressing my regret. And that's kind of what it sounded like when I went to them, is that, you know, I went to them with a forgiving spirit, confessing my former ill feelings, and I expressed that I regretted that it came to this with our family. And it wasn't about pointing the finger at what they did, but just honestly expressing my regret that the situation had tore apart the family. And they were so impressed by the fact that I would go to them and discuss this with them, it completely changed my relationship with all of that side of the family. I didn't point the finger at them and what they did. I didn't go to them groveling, asking for any forgiveness for what I had done, because I believed I did the right thing. You know, I hired an attorney, and we went after them after they attacked us in court. So, attacked us legally. So I felt that I did the right things. I didn't regret hiring an attorney to protect what I believed was mine. What I regretted was that we had to go through
the family.
And we all got free of the hatred that had built up in the family.
So you didn't actually harm them, but you went and made amends anyway because you had no feeling.
I don't believe I harmed them by hiring an attorney after they hired an attorney to.
So you sometimes just go and the people you just used to, you know, don't like and confess your former ill feelings? or is it you're going there to amend a harm? And
there was a lot of harm. There was a lot of tension in the family as a result of all of the things that transpired through this legal battle. I didn't make amends for protecting myself and my side of the family, right? But I certainly felt that I had to express my regret that
it came to that.
That it came to that,
yeah.
And that it tore apart the family.
So it also talks about where somebody has harmed you more than you harmed them. And this is hard to talk about, but I think it's appropriate. One of my amends was a graveside amends to my father. My father was a pedophile, and he molested me as a child when I was 5 till I was 9. And then I was put into institutions and foster homes. So I resented my father for that. So, of course, he made my resentment inventory. And seeing that going through the whole process and getting to amend, I saw that I had used that to my benefit, and that it was a great story for the girls to feel sorry for me or whatever. And I saw very clearly that I had used it for my own benefit. Now, how do I get... How do I see my part? I see the where I played a part in this resentment or in this harm, but I had to also realize that I couldn't forgive my that I had to forgive my father for what he had done by not letting him off the hook, but not by not hanging on to the resentment. Does that make sense? I had to let go of this resentment because it was a killer, and I saw that I had harmed my father in the sense that I got older, I hit him a few times, I slandered him, I told people about his activities, I tried to get him arrested. He ended up dying when I was 18, and we were just starting to like communicate again, and so how do I get free of the resentment is what's most important. So I saw that I had, that he was doing the best he could with what he knew. And whatever was within him to do that was wrong. So I didn't forgive, I forgave him in the sense of not hanging on to that resentment. I didn't let him off the hook. Forgiveness isn't about letting somebody off the hook. But forgiveness is about seeing what they were capable of doing, as well as the things that I wasn't capable of doing. This is a sick man just like myself. How can I be helpful? That kind of attitude came into this. So I made amends to that, and I got free. I got free of that. It was two approaches at the gravesite with that. It's a very deep-seated resentment. It took a lot to dig that out and to get free of that. But again, what my father did was wrong.
Graveside amends can be really powerful. And I think that they're definitely... it's definitely an important part of the nine-step process. By the time I got sober, both my mother, grandmother, and grandfather, and father had passed away. So there was the only way that I could make amends to them is graveside, and I found it helpful to bring a picture with them of them. Sit it on their grave. I had filled out an index card just like I do with everybody else with the list of the harms that I was aware of. And I did it basically the same way as I did all the rest. I just did it in a prayerful way. Sat at the gravesite, sat quietly for a little bit, prayed into it, asking God to guide the experience. right? And basically talked to each one of the relatives that were in the grave as if they were sitting in front of me, saying, "This is why I'm here. These are the harms that I caused that I'm aware of." And then I'd ask this question that I asked everybody else. Is there anything else that you need to tell me that where I've caused harm that I haven't mentioned? And then I'd sit quietly, and for most of the great side of ends, I didn't hear any response. But where it was most important, I did, because I was sitting at my grandmother's grave. She was the last one. She outlived everybody that was there at the graveyard. And when I asked, I said, "This is the harms that I'm aware of. Is there any other harms that I didn't mention that you need to communicate to me or tell me about?" And I sat quiet, right? And what came to me after that just blew me away, because the sense of her voice came to me saying, there's no way that you could possibly repay me for how you've lived. And at this point, the people that I had actually harmed was my brothers, who were the beneficiary of the estate. And then hearing that just blew me away, because the fact was that I mentioned it earlier on, you said that you were homeless and I was in an apartment.
Right.
The fact is, I wasn't paying for an apartment. I really manipulated that situation. I fixed plumbing and paid myself. I didn't pay rent. I basically milked the situation to survive, and was buying alcohol with the money, and basically I was stealing. I was stealing from family to survive. So to hear this at the gravesite is that who is actually harmed by my actions at this point were my brothers. And what came to me is that I had to go to my brothers with these things that I had done to my family, to my grandmother. And I had to bring those same things up with them, because they were the ones that were out money at that point. So,
question over here. No, it's all right. Go ahead, keep going. I'll just say that.
Okay.
Go ahead. Oh, no, I was just going to ask, you know what, about my family situation again? When I went back and made amends to the family members and got on good terms with all of them, but now I'm pissed off because now I want them to all get along. And is that me being selfish, or is it just me?
Playing guys.
Playing guys. Right, you know, back to the...
Because they split, you know, well, you know the story.
Again, it's nice that you were able to make amends to your family. It's certainly productive. But you certainly have no control over what other people do amongst each other. I know that there's a lot of questions that come up over the ninth step, but the recording's coming up to a time when we have to stop it, so we'll be glad to field questions after we stop the recording. So in summary, I'd like to say that there was a lot of power in finishing all amends. Finishing all the amends brought me to a place where I saw where I saw God prove that He could work in my life, that He could move me beyond my limitations. The fears and the conditions that came up during the ninth step, you know, were things that I didn't think that I could ever do. Yet, as a result of praying into it and trusting and relying on God, I saw that I could walk through those fears, that I got the courage to do all of these things and to complete all of the amends that I was aware of, right? And the result of that was being in a place that I was never familiar with. You know how when I thought I actually, when I had finished my last amends, I kind of was just, I thought I was coming down with the flu or something. You know how when you get that kind of empty feeling? Right? And when it wasn't going away, I kind of realized that, I said, no, I'm not sick. I'm just not used to being in a place where I was completely free of all of these things. You know, and I finished the inventory, I read the fifth step, I looked at all these defects of character, became willing to turn to God with all of the stuff, I've made all these amends, and I'm left in this place of where I'm just completely clean with the world.
Wow.
And I had never been in that place, and I felt it, right? And I saw it.
So yeah, this is about what we're going to look at next, is about being current, staying that way. And you know, after you do all of that work, you do feel empty. What do I do now? You've done all of this intense work and you've like got on the other side of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what do I do now?
Yeah. Is there other questions about the ninth step? I saw some hands up. It just moved. Ran out of time on the tape.
I've had, Dan, you know my story. Since the criminal past, I sought out permission to go back and make amends to the criminal. Stuff that I've done, serious, like hardcore felonies, or people that I did crimes with. Then we're cool with me going back to those people. What do you suggest in that situation?
The advice of the book is that we have no right to incriminate others in our quest to make all of our amends.
So is that where seek out permission and consult with others come in?
If you talk to them and they don't want the issue to come up again, then there's not much you could do. Being willing and completely ready to make the amends, all the amends that you can make, goes a long way. And the fact that there is going to be some that maybe you can't, is not, and when I say can't, I mean can't because of other situations, like other people. It's just, some people get frustrated hearing that, but we have to be careful not to be so, obsessed with our own program, that we're going to bring more harm to others. And in that case, even if they deserve it, it's not fair. That might have been sounded like a judgment. It wasn't. I'm just saying, even though they were involved in what you said you were willing to make amends for, they're not in the program. It would possibly cause more harm to them and their families to bring them into the situation from the past.
When I first read it, it said confess former ill feeling, and I'm like, well, if I truly don't know how I felt about them, that's harmful.
It can be, and in certain situations, it would be very useful. That's why we're using God here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when do I express that? You know, but that whole thing is about my thinking now. You know, my thinking can be harmful when I'm harboring ill feelings. That means that I'm in some type of resentment. Now, would I go to somebody and tell them about my ill feelings if it was necessary? If I see the God moving me in that direction, I would do that. But in some situation, that would probably be inappropriate. So that's why we stay out of the sorting that out business.
I think that it comes out differently too when you're going to them with a forgiving spirit. I don't know that, you know, the situations where that came up for me, confessing my ill feelings, it wasn't like I was telling them something they didn't know. Right? So the fact that I went to them with a forgiving spirit and brought up what they already knew, I think was helpful.
Because I phrased it like, you know, I was my guilt was not that how they felt, or they made me feel, just that I was sick.
Uh-huh.
That I was harboring these sick feelings because I was sick. I was trapped up in them, and I was trapped up in selfishness. I was preventing that guilt there. But I wanted to be, that's why I run it by a sponsor and read it to Dave or somebody, you know, to make sure that there's nothing pointing at them that would be harmful.
Right. I think most important is to make sure that whatever we're going to be doing is not going to create more harm while we're doing it. Because that's not what we're there for.
I've made amends for making amends. Mm-hmm. Done it.
That makes me cringe just thinking.
Making amends
and the amends was harmful and created more harm than if I had just left it alone. I think if you stay in prayer and you're depending on God and the right thought or action is going to come. It's going to come. And you got to put your faith in the process and in your faith in this God that you just have a new relationship with, to guide and direct you, and hopefully it'll speak through others, or it's a feeling that you have in your heart, you know. And I think that's the power of the whole process. You know, we can give you tidbits about what you should and shouldn't do, but bottom line is where does it stand from your Creator speaking through you through your heart?
There's not a hard or fast rule for the people that don't want to see you, don't have anything to do with you.
I got a great example of that. There was this girl I harmed, and I called up her father to get her phone number, and I wasn't home. This is a time when we had answering machines, and I came home and there was a message on the machine: if you ever talk to me or anyone in my family, I will have you eradicated from the face of the earth. Can you believe that alone?
Yeah.
So
do we want to take a quick break and come back and do another the 10, 11, and 12?